Hello, welcome to another episode of Travels Through Time, the history podcast made in partnership with Dynamochrome, the brilliant photo colorists who bring the past back to life.
I'm Violet Moller, and in this episode, Kelsey Wilson-Lee is going to take us to visit the splendid court of the Plantagenet King, Edward I, in the year 1297. Edward I's queen, Eleanor of Castile, gave birth 15 or 16 times during their long and apparently happy marriage. Only six of her babies survived childhood. One precious son, who went on to rule after his father's death as Edward II, and five daughters, Eleonora, Joanna, Mary, Margaret, and Elizabeth. Their stories have been eloquently told for the first time by Kelsey Wilson-Lee in her book, Daughters of Chivalry. Kelsey makes brilliant use of the limited sources that survive about these women, so that we can imagine the feasts they attended, the fabulous clothes they wore, and how their lives were intertwined in the wider political story of Britain, Ireland, and Europe in the late 13th century. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Kelsey Wilson-Lee.
Thank you.
This week, we're going to be talking about the daughters of King Edward I, who was one of the Plantagenets. Kelsey has written a book called Daughters of Chivalry, which is about the forgotten children of Edward I. I wonder, Kelsey, how you came to that subject.
So I came to the subject, really, I had been looking for a way to tell the real story of some medieval princesses. You know, the daughters of the English king who had a kind of unified experience. There's lots of wonderful books out there that have come out in recent decades about English queens. But obviously the difference between queens and a princess is the queens were all importing their own cultural backgrounds from France, from Spain, from the Low Countries. And I'm trying to figure out a good mode of telling the story. And I came across these five sisters, and they seemed kind of a perfect set because there were a lot of them in one generation, an unusual number, five.
Yes.
It's rare in the period for that many to survive to adulthood. They had quite distinct experiences from one another. So amongst themselves, they told the kind of story of what a princess could be collectively. And also in this particular generation, there's a really wonderful surviving set of sources that really allow us to dive into their kind of day-to-day lives in a way that is not as easy with other generations.
Wonderful. That's interesting. So it might be useful for the listeners if you could just very briefly tell us a little introduction to each daughter.
Sure.
Is that all right?
Absolutely. So the eldest surviving daughter is Eleonora, and she's born in 1269, and she's born before her parents go off on crusade. They leave very soon after, and she's by herself with her two elder brothers who end up, unfortunately, dying while her parents are gone. Mm-hmm. By the time her parents return back, there have been two more children, one of whom is a little girl, Joanna, who was born in Acre on crusade, and who's been left in the care, who didn't come back to England with her parents, was left in the care of her maternal grandmother in northern France as a kind of companion. And they've also brought a little boy called Alfonso, who is the heir apparent for many years until he tragically dies at the age of 10. The first child born after Edward has become king, there's a daughter born called Margaret, 1275. And Margaret grows up, she's the most challenging of these particular sisters to locate a personality.
Right.
She seems very conventional. She okay. seems like she was striving to be what people expected her to be. And it's very difficult to imagine why that is. But that is Margaret. The next daughter to be born in 1278 is Mary. And she's a very interesting character.
She's fascinating. Yeah, I liked reading about her.
Everybody likes Mary. I like Mary. Mary is assigned at an extraordinarily young age, the age of six, to join a convent as a nun initially to be a companion to her paternal grandmother, who has joined this convent. But, you know, after her grandmother dies, Mary stays on and becomes a fully professed nun. She is a wonderful example of, she forces us to reconsider our own assumptions. Because I think as a modern person, I know I have a knee-jerk reaction. I see a person in religious vocation and I assume, well, this must be a very pious, you know, religious yeah. person. Mary was very much not a particularly...
But presumably that's partly because it wasn't her vocation. It was sort of forced upon her as a very small child.
It was forced upon her as a small child, but I think it also is because it was almost more of a kind of career than a vocation in the way we kind of think of it in terms of a kind of a religious calling.
Yeah.
And I think that's perhaps true for quite a lot of medieval aristocratic women who ended up becoming nuns.
Yeah.
But Mary has a fabulously unexpected life as a nun. And that is the kind of saving grace of her story, is she is nowhere near as constrained as one might have expected her to be.
No, and she definitely enjoys the luxuries of life. She's not sort of sleeping on a board.
She does, exactly. She's not. And even actually in some ways she has the benefit of not having to face the dangers of childbirth and the kind of anxieties of international politics that her sisters cannot
under
escape.
Under control of another man.
Exactly.
And I thought it was quite normal, or quite often, that one child would be, you know, one royal child would go into a monastery or a convent. But actually, you say in the book that this hadn't happened to anyone in the English royal family for 100 years.
It's just most people didn't have that many daughters that survived.
Right.
So, I mean, a daughter, if you're the king and you have daughters, they're quite valuable, and these represent opportunities for international matches. As do sons, I think, is something that we need to not forget.
Yes.
Particularly younger sons also are good opportunities for matchmaking. But you need a surplus of daughters to be willing to give one away.
Yes.
And then the fifth daughter, Elizabeth, is the one with whom we started.
Yeah.
She was born in 1282, the youngest of the girls, the second youngest of all children. She was very, very close with her mother when she was little, the only of Eleanor of Castile's many children that Eleanor kept with her personally for the first several years in her household. So she would have had day-to-day contact like we do now with our children. And that was exceptional within the family. Tragically, Eleanor went away to Gascony for several years in the late 1280s. And by the time she came back and was reunited with her daughter, Elizabeth, who was at that point 8 years old, she was very rapidly failing in health and then died in 1290.
Yeah.
So Elizabeth had this very, very intense relationship with her mother as a small child, and then her mother was taken away.
And she famously, Edward I famously had those 12 crosses built, didn't he? Of her body back to...
That's right, yes, the Eleanor crosses. One of the most extraordinary testaments to...
To their love. It obviously was a love match as well. So, Kelsey, if you could travel back in time, which year would you go back to?
So I chose to go back to 1297.
Right. What is happening in 1297? Can you take us to your first scene, which I believe is Ipswich in England, in the east of England, and it's January. Where are we and what is going on?
So we're in Ipswich, the 8th of January into the later period of January, and we are at the wedding of the youngest daughter of Edward I, her name by his first wife. Her name is Elizabeth, who is 14 years old and has just married the young 12-year-old Count of Holland, who's called Jan or Johan. They are due to depart back with his family and his kind of court of nobles back to Holland, where she and he will take up the kind of the roles of count and countess. And the royal party travel down from Ipswich to Harwich, which is on the coast. They're met by a fleet of ships, which has been described by a contemporary chronicler as inestimably ornamented, an incredibly rich fleet of Dutch ships, of British ships. It's got one of the king's finest ships, the Swan of Yarmouth, is there. Mm-hmm. And it's filled to the brim with the bridal goods, the trousseau of Elizabeth and her older sister Margaret. And Elizabeth and Margaret are both meant to be traveling to the Low Countries to join their husbands. Margaret has previously, 7 years before, married the young Duke of Brabant, which is around Brussels, the area around Brussels. They're both traveling over. And they're virtually on the point of embarking. And suddenly Elizabeth, again, she's 14, she decides she doesn't want to go.
Understandable, perhaps.
Understandable, very understandable. And it's we don't know precisely why she didn't want to go. We might be able to guess. We don't know precisely what she said to her father when she told him she didn't want to go. But we do know how he reacted. And that is because there's a record that survives in the King's Wardrobe book, which is these wonderful sources where they recorded all of the expenditure of the royal household, where the king writes to his goldsmith and he asks him for a great ruby and a great emerald that would be bought to set into a certain coronet of the Countess of Holland, the king's daughter. This is Elizabeth. In place of two stones which were lost when the king threw the coronet into the fire.
In a fit of rage.
Well, this is the historian's interpretation has been broadly that this what has happened is the daughter has said, no, I'm not going. And her father, incensed at perhaps at what he perceived as filial disobedience, but also what he probably perceived to be a threat to his very important military alliance with the Dutch, which was critical in 1297 to his plans. He perceived that to be threatened by her gesture of refusing to go.
Perhaps you can give us a bit of background about Edward I. Is this a characteristic way for him to behave? And what's his relationship like with his children?
So this is the only known instance, or at least the only instance I know of, where there's a kind of flash of violent temper between with Edward and his relationship with his daughters. He does have some later on, some flashes of violence which are recorded with his son, Edward II, when they start to have some troubles later. Edward was very used to getting his own way. Edward was under particular pressure in 1297, in part as a kind of long-term buildup of problems he had had with his nobles and his knights and the populace more broadly around taxation. Edward had been at war for decades.
Yeah, war, on several fronts.
On several fronts. And war is expensive. And he had depleted his own coffers with wars in Wales, with building extraordinarily expensive castle programs across North Wales. They had fought a battle in 1296. They'd done a campaign against the Scots where they had, you know, sought to what was at that point considered quite a successful campaign to subdue the Scots and make them kind of come back to paying homage to the English king. And then in 1297, Edward decided he had to go to war against France. As well, France was the wildly dominant nation. This is a country of a lot of power and might. And he once again summoned his nobles, demanded military service of them.
Which is expensive for them as well.
Expensive, it's dangerous. You're having to be away from home.
Yeah.
You don't get to focus on your own plans and projects. And the nobles were quite incensed, actually. The clerical laity had obtained license from the Pope to ignore the taxation from the crown. The nobles obviously couldn't appeal to the Pope, but they did launch their own set of complaints. Notably, they argued the king wanted to open two separate fronts in a war with France. Himself was going to plan to lead a campaign from the north down from Flanders. He wanted to send a separate contingent down through Gascony to open up a second front in the southwest.
Yeah.
And he needed the allies that he had in his daughter's marriages.
Yes.
The Duke of Brabant and the Count of Holland and their nearby parties. He needed them in order to be able to hold this thing together.
Yeah, and he didn't want his daughter jeopardizing that. I'd just like to ask you a bit about female education, because I think that was quite important with regards to their daughters. So can you tell us what evidence we have or what you know about how she had her daughters educated?
Sure. So Eleanor bought books for her children to learn to read. So the kind of standard way of learning to read, if you were a medieval noble, lay noble, would have been to kind of learn to sound out letters, not wildly dissimilar to children nowadays, generally from a book that had large, easy to read text, something like a Psalter. At least one of them, Eleonora, who's the oldest, was also learning to write, which was actually a quite exceptionally rare skill. We know that she was learning to write because there were writing tablets bought for her at a number of different times by her tailor.
So that's interesting that in those days, reading and writing didn't necessarily go together.
That's right.
Like they do now.
Yes, exactly. And again, we do think of it as going together, but
they
are. I know that I'm teaching my four-year-old to read and to write. And actually, it's a very different, he approaches these as very different skills.
Yeah.
And I think it's only because of the way we've been trained that we kind of think
associate
of them together.
Yeah, so much. So going back to these two princesses who are on the brink of a voyage to Holland, tell us a bit about Margaret, because she'd actually got married quite a long time before, hadn't she? She was supposed to go to the continent, but she refused.
Margaret was married in 1290 to the young Duke of Brabant. They were both 15 when they were married. He had lived, like the young Count of Holland, the both young men had come over after their betrothals and grown up at the English court. So they were...
So they would have known each other quite well.
They would have known each other very well. Margaret and he spend the first several years of their married lives continuing to live within the English royal household, traveling around. Then his father dies and he is called back by the nobles...
But must we not be able to infer a certain amount about her relationship with her father by the fact that she wasn't forced? I mean, presumably she could, in theory, have been forced to go.
That's right.
With her husband, and
sure.
she wasn't.
She
so
was not.
Does that? What do you think, if anything, we can infer about her relationship with her father from that?
Edward didn't force any of his daughters ever at those critical moments. He never seemed to force any of them to do something
they seemed to have had a really genuinely loving relationship.
I think they probably did. It is notoriously difficult to read back into these things. But he certainly was very forgiving in the moments when his daughters, and almost all of them at different times in their lives, showcased willfulness, disobedience.
Yeah.
And yet he was quite easy. He was ready to forgive them. He found it a lot easier to forgive them. A lot easier
after
than...
being a bit angry at the beginning.
Yeah. He struggled much more in being forgiving of his son.
Hello, I'm John Hillman, one of the producers on the Travels Through Time podcast. Now, have you ever looked at an old photograph and wondered what it would look like if it was taken in colour? Well, our amazing partners over at Dynamochrome do just this. Jordan Lloyd at Dynamochrome is one of the world's leading photo colourists, having spent years refining a technique that allows him to transform the black and white past into full high definition colour. The colour and the realism that they achieve really has to be seen to be believed. You can see some of Dynamochrome's finest work on our website. Pictures of Abraham Lincoln in 1865, the D-Day beaches in June 1944, and the famous March on Washington in 1963. So, do you have a favourite black and white photograph that you'd like to see colourised? These prints make fabulous and utterly unique presents. So, if you want to find out more, head over to dynamochrome.com.
Wonderful. So, let's go now to your second scene, which is a little bit later that year. And we've moved from Ipswich to St Albans, where the king is holding court. And something extremely dramatic has happened involving his daughter Joanna, who seemed to me to be the most rebellious and headstrong of all of his children. So tell us what's happening.
So Joanna was, to step back a little and say, Joanna was at the age of 18, the same year her sister Margaret got married to the Duke of Brabant. Joanna, at the age of 18, married a much older man in his 40s called Gilbert de Clare, who was one of the most powerful lords in her father's kingdom. And he was an English lord and also a lord of the Welsh Marches. Joanna married him. They had a number of children. She did travel with him, just like her mother did. She went with him when he traveled abroad to Ireland, which she didn't have to. Mm. So I think she mustn't have hated him.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it clearly was a relationship that was imposed upon her. She was certainly, if she was convinced to do it, she was convinced quite heavily to do it.
Can you just explain about the inheritance? Because that was really fascinating and quite complicated.
You mean how he disinherited his children?
Well, when they got married,
okay,
the king did this extraordinary thing, and she was in a really unique position, wasn't she?
So when Joanna and Gilbert get married, the king forces Gilbert to do two things. The first thing is to rearrange his whole estate so that it is not held by Gilbert, but is instead jointly held by Gilbert and Joanna. And the critical difference there is if Gilbert dies before Joanna, instead of inheriting a token portion of his estate to look after her own self until she dies, she will inherit the entire estate. He also says if he dies without any heirs by Joanna, the estate will go to her heirs, regardless of if they're with another man. Now, the reason this is particularly shocking is Gilbert had legitimate heirs of his own. He had two daughters from his first marriage, who were disinherited. It was quite a shocking gesture, but it was one Gilbert was willing to make because this got him very close to the king.
It got him a princess.
Got him a princess. One of the things Gilbert in turn also had to swear allegiance that if Edward died without any male heirs, Gilbert would not, as the husband of the second daughter, would not seek to become king, but would support the claim of the eldest daughter, Eleonora. So it was quite an unusual arrangement. But when Gilbert dies, this means that he does die. They have three daughters and a son. So there will be an heir. There are heirs. But when Gilbert dies, Joanna inherits the entire estate.
And when we're not just talking about a sort of normal estate. It's land in 25 counties.
That's right.
Which I think is a fairly extraordinary statistic.
It's one of the largest estates in the country.
So there's land in Ireland, there's land, a lot of Wales.
There's lots of, yes.
And then all over
huge
England.
Tracts of Wales all over England, from York to Kent to Somerset to, Gloucestershire. It's a very widespread, very, very rich estate. I think it's valued somewhere around £6,000 a year. It's an extraordinarily valuable estate. And Joanna overnight becomes one of the most wealthy lords in her father's kingdom, regardless of the fact that she's a woman. And she has this extraordinary moment in 1296 when she kneels in homage to her father as his feudal vassal, and they go through the whole ceremonial process. And she then has this unusual relationship. This is her father, but this is also her feudal lord.
Yeah. And this, it was so surprising when I read about it because, you always imagine in the medieval period as a woman, you're either the property of your father or the property of your husband, and you have no legal rights over your own children. But it seems that if you're widowed, it's a very different situation. And actually, you have got a lot of power. You effectively have the same power that you would almost if you were a man.
If you are a widow, you're right. It is absolutely, it's the first time you become a kind of legally autonomous person.
Yeah.
You can sue and be sued. You can own property. You can represent yourself. Medieval Europe is filled with stories of women who kind of, when they find themselves in this position of widowhood, some of them become very, very formidable lords in their own right. And there absolutely are those women in the 13th century. I think it would have been harder for Joanna for a couple of reasons. One, she was still very young. She was only
23, wasn't she,
yes,
when he died?
Yes, in her 20s. She's just such a good catch. It's hard for her to have been allowed to have remained a widow.
Yeah.
And indeed, her father...
Well, but that was what I was going to say. Of course, the downside to having this power was that widows were very much looked upon in society as they were portrayed as sort of being either unstable and incapable of, ruling their assets, or as being very lascivious and sort of unable to control themselves sexually. And as we're about to hear, that did slightly play out in the case of Joanna.
That's right. Yes.
Not that I blame her. She's 23 years old.
The particularly young widows, it was often recommended that they remarry, in part because people didn't like the idea of
a young, powerful woman.
Powerful woman. Right? But also this is a quite patriarchal, quite misogynist at core society. Yeah. And women were still thought to be kind of uncontrolled women who were not controlled from outside, were thought to be sexually deviant,
dangerous,
lascivious. You know, it was a fear that particularly was manifested in terms of when you had these women in these positions of power.
Yeah,
they seemed scarier.
And Joanna definitely did not Joanna, do anything to dispel
it. Joanna did that. Not dispel it.
So tell us what she
had done. So Joanna in some point in 1296 must have become enamored with, developed a relationship with one of the young men in her husband's household who was still lived within her household in Wales. And she sends him off. He's basically nobody. I mean, he comes from no discernible, meaningful, noble background.
Yeah, and in those days, that was important.
That was very, very important. I mean, this is a princess. You know, and she can't quite manage to kind of countenance the idea of marrying just a nobody. So she sends him off to her father and has him knighted. She says to her father, please knight this young kind of gentleman. He's done me good service. Her father, having no clue he's doing or what's going on, dutifully knights the young man, sends him back to Joanna, who promptly marries him in secret. Oops.
Because she'd also had to promise. Didn't she have to make an explicit promise to her father that she wouldn't remarry without his permission? Or
that's right.
Like
so
that?
She holds land in chief from the king, which means she holds her land directly from the king. If she, whoever she marries, because of this, the rule that the husband, if the estate is owned by the woman, once she remarries, the husband will have a vast amount of power and money. And the king doesn't want somebody who he doesn't choose or get a veto power on to suddenly be one of the most wealthy, powerful lords in his country. Of course he doesn't want that. So she has now violated this kind of trust, essentially, in two separate ways. She's put her father in a difficult position and her feudal lord. And her father hears about this, and he initially doesn't know what to think. He sends his personal confessor off to go find her, track her down in Wales, and get the truth out of her.
But isn't it worse? Because actually, in the interim, he's been busy getting ready to marry her to somebody called Amadeus. Where's Amadeus from?
He's from Savoy. Right? So yes, right. You're right. In the interim, this nobleman, important nobleman from slightly to the east of France, is saying has kind of cottoned on to the idea that, hey, there's this princess available, and she has a vast amount of money herself.
She's a real catch.
She's now even more of a catch. And he kind of, is thinking, well, how would that sound? And Edward clearly hears this. If Amadeus had launched a third front in a war against France, coming from the east, from the north, the east, and the southwest, he's clearly
thinking strategically.
Strategically, this could work out quite well. Unfortunately for him, he doesn't realize that Joanna's already married. By the time he learns that Joanna is already married, she's visibly pregnant. So we're moving fast forward into May at this point, and Joanna kind of realizes she's got to come face the music. So she comes and admits she's pregnant. The husband is promptly imprisoned, and all of her lands and estates are confiscated, and the king Edward is very, very cross.
And this is when we're in St. Albans,
and she is ushered before her father in July, around the end of July, and she has one kind of chance to make this all work and get back her her man and her estate and kind of have beaten the system.
Yes. And incredibly, we actually have part of or all of her speech.
Extraordinarily. This is only
will
one
you
of
this a bit of
I will. This is one of only two instances I know of where late medieval princesses' actual spoken words are recorded.
Wow.
And it was recorded by a monk from St. Albans who in the preamble to his recording of it says he recorded it because it was illustrative of her spirit and the spirit of her whole family. So this is thought to be
how
kind of indicative of her spirit. And Joanna says, "It is not considered ignoble or disgraceful for a great and powerful earl to join himself in legal marriage with a poor and lesser woman. Therefore, in the same manner, it is not reprehensible or too difficult a thing for a countess to promote a gallant youth." So what's interesting about that is it sounds logical, right? If a man can do it, surely a woman can.
I like her logic. I like her reasoning.
Undeniable. And yet it completely is against the kind of contemporary belief that really did say men could elevate a virtuous maiden of no parentage, could elevate her through marriage, but that same power did not exist for women to do that
for
men.
Women went down.
Well, yeah, exactly. Women could go up or down, but men, no matter who they married, they stayed the same.
Yeah.
And so the fact that Joanna gets away with this, and she does get away with it, her father forgives her, the husband is forgiven. A couple days later in August, he's there kneeling side by side with her, and they perform a new ceremony of homage to her father. And
the lands are restored.
The lands are restored. Everybody's happy. And
amazing.
It's extraordinary.
One of the things in relation to the whole idea of marriage and of love, I think, is very interesting. I'd like you to expand on. You know, we have all these romances you mentioned, which are stories of, you know, true love. And then you have that contrasting with all these princesses who are all in arranged marriages. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder how that work, that sort of interplay, especially in this case of Joanna, who obviously has had her arranged marriage and they didn't seem to be unhappy. I mean, they had lots of children and she, as you said, she went with him. But then she's now fallen in love. And I just wonder how that worked in society, where there seemed to be this sort of chivalric glorification of love and true love. And yet, in reality, people were being forced into marriages all the time. That was very normal. I wonder how that worked.
So, I mean, to be honest, I think there is continuing debate amongst scholars about the extent to which these romance tropes were kind of escapist fantasies to help people get through the fact that their own marriages were not going to have that. Or if they might actually have been considered, as I think Joanna was clearly reading them, as kind of potential real options. I don't think there's any necessary agreement.
Yeah.
My own feeling is that if you are reading constant kind of, you're constantly surrounded by romance tropes. And these stories, many of them, they were not just present in their reading material. They were, you know, on tapestries woven around, they were kind of, you know, on their jewel caskets. They're kind of omnipresent in chivalric culture.
Yeah.
The fact that these stories, there are stories, I mean, stories of secret weddings, they're rare, but they're not that rare.
Yeah.
Joanna's daughter has a secret wedding, you know, a couple decades later. You know, one of her aunts had a secret wedding. It is an unanswerable question in some ways because I don't know that we will ever really know. But it is interesting to think about. It's also interesting that both Edward I and Eleanor of Castile and his parents, Henry III and Eleanor of Provence, although they were arranged marriages, they were very, very close unions. And I do think
You could be lucky, couldn't you? I guess you could.
But I think for the children of this generation, they would have expect it. If you saw your parents loving each other and your grandparents,
you'd expect that for
yourself. You'd expect that for yourself.
Yeah, or hope.
Or hope for yourself.
So now I think we should go to your third scene, which is Christmas time. And we've taken a boat across the channel and we're in Ghent in Belgium. Is that correct? Flanders?
Yep. Who's
there celebrating Christmas? What's going on?
So Edward has finally come to war against France, or he's tried to. And he's brought with him his recalcitrant daughter, Elizabeth, who didn't want to go to Holland at the beginning of the year, but has agreed to come with him. And they come over with a big army, and they get to Ghent, and they're waiting and waiting for Edward's allies, continental allies, to all show up so they can all go to war in a synchronized fashion. Very, very rapidly, that all falls apart. And Edward realizes by the end of October that he's got to settle with the French. He's got to come up with a treaty. So unfortunately, he's got a whole army and just thousands of men and horses in Ghent. And you got to get everybody back.
Yeah, and he's got to feed them as well.
Feed them.
While they're there.
Exactly. And it's all very expensive. The comparative cash poor nature of the crown throughout this year is kind of, it touches on every one of these moments.
Yeah.
So Edward is there. His daughter Elizabeth stays with the royal household. Her two sisters come over, who she hasn't seen in a while. Margaret, who we left, who set sailing off for Bremen in January. Margaret comes with her husband, and they come and spend Christmas festivities. And also the oldest sister, Eleonora, comes over. But they also have an interesting, who I think the most interesting additional guest at this Christmas festivity is their cousin Marie. Now, Marie is their father's sister's daughter, right? The first cousin. She had grown up in the same kind of household as Eleonora, the oldest daughter. But since her mother died in the 1270s, her family has drifted more closely to their French relations. And in fact, Marie's husband and father are technically at war with Edward's court.
So they are, of course, all related.
They're all related.
Royal families, aren't they?
They're all related, and yet
they're at war with each other. Yeah, it's a complex dynamic.
It's a complex dynamic. Yes, and so Marie, you know, Marie's immediate family, her sister has a husband who's dying of this horrible wound that cannot heal, that he got fighting against the Count of Flanders' army. The Count of Flanders is there at Christmas, you know, it's all...
I wonder how that... It must have been very strange, especially for the women who were inevitably the ones who, you know, sort of had to put up with losing their husbands and...
Yeah, so it's an extremely unusual Christmas in terms of it's the people it's bringing together. Because the king doesn't have any money, this very awkward thing happens where he can't feed his men. Right. And once again, Edward, he can't provide sufficient bread. The knights go into the city and they bring back their own bread. And it's another moment of great embarrassment for the king. It's the last moment all of these sisters, these three sisters, are together, because Eleonora dies a year later.
Yeah.
Eleonora, we know she loved almonds as a child, right?
Yes, and she had a dress with thousands of silver buttons.
Yes, she liked silver buttons. Yes, she had lots of dresses with silver buttons sewn onto them. That was clearly her. I like to imagine her kind of like a disco queen.
Yes.
You know, shining in the sun.
And can you tell us a little bit about Ghent? So where would they have stayed in Ghent?
There's a house that they stay in, and that all we know about the house is that it was deemed insufficiently kind of comfortable, in that the king pays to have a new chimney erected in the house. So you can imagine that it wasn't quite up to royal standards.
Yeah.
And so they, but they have a lot of, you know, food brought in. They've got pomegranates and dates and, you know, pears and nuts and things brought in for kind of Christmas time.
Yeah. And so Eleonora dies, sadly, the following year. What happens to Elizabeth and Margaret?
Margaret lives in Brussels for the rest of her life. She has a fairly quiet life. Margaret comes back for her brother's coronation, and which it all goes quite dramatically badly. And this is when the beginning of the nobles' kind of hatred of Piers Gaveston
is
really
Edward II is.
That's right.
Edward very keen on Piers Gaveston.
Yes, he is. And Elizabeth goes to Holland, does not stay there very long. Her young husband, as he matures, falls under the influence of a very powerful courtier. Not very long after, Elizabeth comes back, spends most of her life in England, married to an English count. She seems fairly happy with, they have lots and lots of children, I think 13 or something like that.
Yeah.
And he ends up, he's killed at fighting against her brother, ultimately, in some of the battles of Edward II's, at the end of Edward II's reign.
Yeah.
So that's, yes, Elizabeth dies in childbed, so she doesn't see...
Another very common...
Another quite common thing.
Yeah. So we talked briefly at the beginning about the amount of travel that they all did. And I really think that's quite a surprising feature of the medieval period, that people did travel a lot, or certain people. And can you just give us a little description of how would, you know, the Princess Eleonora have traveled around the country?
So normally on horseback. So you could ride on a horse or you could be in a carriage, and they didn't have kind of suspension.
Yeah, no springs.
No springs, not yet invented.
Would have been very bumpy.
So it would have been very bumpy.
Because the roads were probably...
The roads were very poor.
So they must have been pretty... I mean, we have this sort of idea, and this is how you beautifully start your book, of, you know, shut your eyes and imagine a princess. And, you know, you do imagine, you know, someone in a tower in a beautiful dress with sort of long, slender hands and stuff. But in order to... withstand this level of traveling and being, you know, would have been outside in all weathers. They must have been pretty tough, actually, mustn't they?
I think so.
And very good horsewomen. And...
Absolutely. I mean, Eleanor of Castile, I always think it must have been one tough cookie. I mean, she hunted throughout all of her pregnancies. So she mostly hunted on horseback, particularly with dogs were her favorite.
Yeah.
And so she was hunting, heavily pregnant, constantly traveling. I mean, on the days they traveled, they would have been riding for 8 hours, day after day. Particularly, you know, lots of children did not survive into adulthood, but those that did were ones who could handle this kind of rigor
and were tough.
Yeah.
So there's just one final question that I'd like to ask you, and I imagine there's a lot of answers to this question, but. What would you bring back if you could choose one object from 1297? What would it be?
So the one object I would choose is when Edward, they're at Harwich, and Edward is sending Margaret off finally to Brabant, and he knows that she doesn't want to go, and she's gotten an extra 6 or 7 years of staying at home, but she eventually has to go. He gives her a small gift, which is a little box, and in it is a gold ring. And it's quite a simple thing for the king to have given his daughter, a simple gold ring.
Yeah.
But because it's a circle, I feel that there's a kind of symbolic link of kind of a bond that is unbreakable.
Yeah.
And that he doesn't know if he's going to ever see her again. He does see her again.
Yeah, but he doesn't know that.
But he doesn't know that. Yeah, so I think that would be quite a special thing to be able to bring back. And I think this is one of the kind of main things I come back to time and time again. I think we lose sight of when we think of women, these royal women, as purely as victims. It was a patriarchal culture, yes. But if we think of them purely as victims, we miss out on the active role they played in helping to support their family by going out and building these connections that are invaluable to England's ambitions.
Yeah.
You know, England, the English crown, the family, the dynasty has ambitions to expand, to strengthen itself. And it needs those daughters, those princesses, to go out and make these strong connections.
And also to play the role. They're not just pawns. They're actually going to play a role that they've been prepared for.
So,
lovely. Oh, that's a great way to end. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our chat.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Travels Through Time. We really hope you enjoyed that episode. And don't forget to head over to tttpodcast.com, where you will find lots of other episodes to enjoy, stretching right across history. There was a fantastic one last week about chasing Dr. Livingstone, which we really recommend. So please make sure you check that one out. Otherwise, once again, thanks so much for supporting us in this podcast. And we really look forward to seeing you back here next week.